Welcome to the Hired by Passion podcast. I'm your host, Marcel Richard, and I will be interviewing artists and entrepreneurs on how they were able to escape the 9-to-5 and turn their passion into an income. Hello, and welcome to the Hired by Passion podcast. I'm super happy that you tuned in today. I have an interview for you. With me today is a psychotherapist and meditation teacher who studied with Jack Kornfield and Tara Branch. He is trusted by professional athletes, Fortune 500 executive, and Grammy Award-winning entertainers. Prior to becoming a therapist, he worked as a speaker and consultant to some of the world's largest brands, or some stuff like that. He tells me that all of it is true, but he feels it makes him look seem bigger than he is. I've been following his writing for over a year now on his blog, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity to have a chat with Jason Connell. In this episode, we talk about growing up as a child entertainer and maybe the negative aspects of that. We talk about the role of higher education. We talk about how marketing and the news plays with our emotions to make us feel not good enough and how the coaching industry plays a lot on that. We talk about pursuing goals for the wrong reason and that probably they won't bring you the satisfaction that you're hoping that attaining these goals will bring. We talk about being blind to psychological wounds that hold us back from achieving our goals. And in the end, Jason has some questions for me about what I'm looking for in life and how I'm looking for things externally when maybe I should start looking more internally. And this brought up a lot of reflection on my part. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with Jason Connell. Hello and welcome to the Hired by Passion podcast. I'm here with my guest, Jason Connell. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the Hired by Passion podcast. I've been looking forward to this for probably over a month now. So thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
I'd like to ask you the first question that I always ask. And it's the famous, when somebody asks you the question, what do you do? What's your answer to that question?
Well, I mean, the technical answer is that I am a meditation teacher and a therapist. I think of my job, though, a little differently. I think it's my job, or at least my aspiration, to help people build a life that they fall in love with for themselves and a fairly strong sense of self-worth and self-esteem.
So this has changed tremendously throughout your life. And that's that's exactly what I want to talk to you about. And if we started maybe close to the beginning when you were growing up as a teenager, you were a magician. I'm kind of curious, how did you get into magic and what was that like? What did that represent for you growing up?
So I got into magic through a weird sequence of events. My dad knew a few magic tricks and he would show them to me. This is when I was like 6 or 8 and I was mesmerized by them. And then by coincidence, my mother took me shoe shopping, and the owner of the shoe store was a former magician and former entertainment manager. I'm like 6 or 8 years old at this point. Yeah. And he sold me a magic trick and said, come back and show me your progress. And I did that. And very long story short, he ended up coming out of retirement when I was a child to groom me and teach me how to be a magician, teach me the art of stagecraft and the business of entertainment. And that lasted until I was 18. And you had asked, what did this mean to me? And I think a lot of times when we see child entertainers or when we think about child entertainers, we think that it's a really nice thing for the child. And that was not my experience. And if I'm going to be transparent about my path and how I wound up working in meditation and therapy, I think it's important to understand that being a child entertainer for me was very, very, very isolating, very difficult. It was a very abnormal and unpleasant childhood, or part of my childhood, I should say. And magic, sort of unique among the other art forms, rewards perfectionism. If a magician does something unnatural, the audience feels as though they understand what's happening and the effect is ruined. So the magician has to be perfect, or as much as one can. And to train that, you have to identify all the imperfections. The other catch here with magic is when you watch a magic trick, even if you're just your friends at a party or something, the agreement you're making with the magician is you can lie to me. So magicians become very well-versed in delusional levels of perfectionism, at least I did. And they become very skilled at lying, at least I did. So I learned a lot, but I also did a lot of damage on that path.
So what do you mean by damage? Where do you feel that this hurt you?
Well, as far as I can tell, and I think any effective therapist or meditation teacher would admit that getting a clear glimpse on the human experience is a work in progress. But two things that I think are true, at least right now where I stand, is one, the more honest we can be with ourselves and with the people that matter, the better our lives will be. So part of the damage that I encountered, and I think many magicians and many people encounter, is we learn to lie. And I think that's mostly to our detriment. The other damage is, I think life is intrinsically messy. And I think there's a lot of beauty and a lot of perfection and a lot of connection inside of that messiness. But performers need to be perfect. And in the Western world, we idolize these people, these actors, these entertainers, these politicians, these athletes who are very stage managed and appear to be perfect. So we, and certainly I, learn this message that I can be happy by blurring my truth and I can be happy by working hard to be perfect. In reality, I think the truth is the exact opposite. I think embracing our messiness and embracing our truth is a truer path to happiness. One thing that many entertainers learn is that they have to earn their worth. You know, you work very hard behind the scenes in rehearsal, and then you get on stage, and if you do well, the audience claps and you get paid.
Yeah.
And I think a far better message, and I think one that's far more true, is that people are intrinsically worthy. And if there is something preventing you from realizing that, we should be curious about it and kind of chip away at that stuff so that you can feel this intrinsic sense of worth.
Yeah, I like that perspective. So when you stopped, was there something that happened that a light bulb turned on and say, okay, I need to stop this? Or how was that? And where did that bring you, I guess?
Well, it's a little difficult to explain, but child entertainers broadly, and certainly myself individually, don't tend to opt in to being child entertainers. These decisions are made for them when they're 6 or 8 or 10, and there's inertia. So I had known towards my mid-teens, 15, 16, something like that, that I wanted to quit magic, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then when I was 18, I was going away to university, and that felt like a clean break for me. So I was like, I'll stop magic when I go to university. And I did. And it was actually, in complete truth, like, it was a little hard because I liked, my ego liked the specialness that came from being a moderately well-known entertainer. But mostly it was easy because I didn't want to be doing that stuff anymore. I just wanted to be normal.
Okay. What about, was it hard to leave the money on the table?
No, I gave it away. Actually, it's funny. I haven't told that story in years. Or maybe ever, now that I think about it. I just wanted to be normal, and normal 18-year-olds in university did not have the same amount of money that I had. So I gave it to a couple of charities, I believed in at the time.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty. What drove you to do that? Well, you said
I just wanted to be normal. Like, really? I know it sounds like there's more there. But I just knew that wasn't my path. I didn't like being a magician, didn't like being different than all my friends. And the money was an artifact of that. So I gave it away. It was really easy. It would have been harder to hold on to it.
Yeah. Really. So I guess to me, the money is security. So, and it's probably just personal because the amount of money I have in my bank account permits me to quit my job and try to do whatever I'm doing right now. And basically kind of gives me time. So I see that as a safety net for time. And you saw that as something that wasn't normal, so you had to get rid of, which is really interesting. So when you started university, I'm not sure if I was able to find what your first major was in.
I started in psychology and I graduated with a degree in political science.
Okay. And that was psychology in Florida, was it?
Yeah, you're good. You did your research.
Yeah. So when you went to... I guess we're kind of skipping because when you almost quit university 2 weeks before it was done, that was in Montreal?
Yeah, I started school in Florida. I got fed up with higher education. I spent a couple of years traveling and volunteering.
Okay.
Went back to school in Canada. And then 2 weeks before, I was still fed up with higher education and was going to make some show of dropping out of school. But I did not. And I'm glad that I did not.
Okay. Well, that is interesting because you wrote that you were not glad that you did not. And that was one of my questions was if you still, because you wrote an article saying that you were kind of disappointed that you didn't trust yourself enough because you knew that was a decision that you had to do. So I do enjoy your candor in saying that your opinion has changed, because a lot of people will kind of stick to their guns. Well, that's the path I chose. And a lot of your writing, you will say, this is how things have changed. And now I'm a different person, and everybody becomes a different person. So I'm kind of curious on your flip-flop, I guess, in saying that you wish that you trusted your gut more, but now you're happy that you finished. So
so you're the second person today to ask about that article, which is funny because, like, of the things that I've written, it's not necessarily one of the more popular ones.
Okay.
But my commitment to anyone that I do public-facing work, that I engage with in a public-facing way, whether it's as a writer or a speaker, is that whatever I say in the moment is true. And I believe I wrote that article in the spring of 2016. So well over 4 years ago at this point. And 4 years ago, we lived in a very different world. The United States, my country, had different leadership. I also was working as a speaker and as a coach. And a lot of my success as a speaker relied on the assumption that expertise and traditional credentialing don't matter. And because I didn't have them. Like, if I thought traditional credentials and expertise mattered, then I would be a big hypocrite. And the world has changed a lot. We went from Barack Obama, who had a lot of experience in politics and who had studied sort of traditional politically things in the United States, to Donald Trump, who has little experience in politics, little expertise there, little credentialing there. And likewise, as the world has changed, I have too. I for a while, my dream was to keep chasing the dragon and get audiences to validate me by standing on stage and speaking. And then when that was no longer interesting, I wanted to help other people become speakers. But I found somewhere along the lines that what I really wanted to do was help people with their mental health. And there's whole industries of coaching and holistic, you know, supplements and oils and all this stuff that argues, no, we can help people with their mental health without traditional credentialing, without evidence-based interventions. And I looked at that stuff and I hung out in those industries for a bit and it felt very wrong to me. And I realized, gosh, you know, grounding in evidence bases for how we heal people's minds and how we mend their hearts matters to me. So I found myself 4 years later needing to eat crow. I publicly proclaimed to all, you know, three people that pay attention to me, who cares about expertise? And then suddenly I closed down at the time what was a very successful business to humble myself and go back to school and be an unpaid intern for well over 1,000 hours. So yeah. I don't know that those things reconcile, but my commitment is that and what I will stand by is that I have been honest to how I saw the world at the time. And I think I remain that way.
And I do fully agree with you. From somebody who has a bachelor's in engineering, a master's in business, I don't believe in higher education either, which is to me, we're just kind of outlets to be that where I've got funneled into engineering because of my academic background. I guess I was doing well in school and math sciences were kind of my thing. So it kind of guided me through there and I didn't like it. So I did a master's in business just to have an out, to have something different. But I still didn't, I don't believe in it too much because I see university as a social club and people who went through that social club want to hire people who went through that social club as well. And that's kind of my thought on higher education. So I kind of understand that. And I see, the article that brought me to your writing, was definitely talking about this, self-help industry and how I was curious for myself, seeing how if a life coach was actually a business, and I don't remember exactly what I Googled, but it was along the lines of, is being a life coach a legitimate business? And your blog is one of the first one that came up, right? So that's how I discovered your writing. And I really loved it because I'm like, wow, somebody who thinks a bit like me, and he wrote a big article about it. So I read another one and another one and another one. And I consumed most of your articles probably like a year ago now. And I've reread just as doing research for this interview, but I'm kind of curious. So your discreditation of the industry is a lot on the mental aspect and people trying to, I guess, heal wounds that go far behind, further than business success, I guess. And I'm wondering if you see that is what it's really about, and that's why people are looking for help with coaches and whatnot? Or do you think that there's still a legitimate industry in helping people attain some goals that are not about curing mental illness?
Sure. I want to speak to that directly, and I will, but I also want to go back to something that I heard you say, Now, there is an element of, now keep in mind, I have done a full 180. I wish that for a while in my life, I wished I dropped out of college because I wanted, or university, because I wanted to be flashy. You know, I went on to work with senior members of President Obama's cabinet, and I wish I had done that without a bachelor's degree, without any education. You had said, you know, university is a social club. Now, that's true. And that's a true problem, especially in the United States, where higher education is prohibitively expensive for people. But I think that nuance matters a lot here. Now, when you are working with something that doesn't directly to pertain to one's well-being, let's just say business, I don't think that education matters a whole lot. You know, you can say that you're selling Facebook ads that convert at whatever rate, and maybe it's true, maybe it's a lie, maybe you have a degree from Dartmouth, maybe you failed out of high school. I don't think it matters all that much, except that it's shitty to lie. But you know, nobody's mental or physical health is at stake here. Nobody's going to die here. No building is going to collapse because it's structurally unsound. However, when we are dealing with people's wellness, whether this is building a building that needs to support tons and tons and tons of weight so it doesn't collapse, or dealing with someone's mental health or dealing with their physical health, I strongly defend higher education and evidence-based interventions. Again, these should be affordable to all. It's criminal that they are not. But in my country, we see with our senior leadership just how dangerous it is to have people that don't have formal training and don't have formal supervision. I mean, Donald Trump's handling of this pandemic has cost tens of thousands and may end up costing 100,000 plus unnecessary deaths in the United States. If he listened to experts that had traditional credentialing, if he were a traditionally groomed and developed politician, tens of thousands of people would be alive. So it's trendy in the blogosphere and on podcasts to dismiss higher education. And again, I got a lot of readers by doing that, but I think it's simplistic to do that. And I think higher education, credentialing, supervision, evidence-based research, scientific methods, I really think these things matter, especially when you're dealing with people's well-being.
I do agree, and I see where you're coming from, and I think this could derail into a whole conversation about just this, which is not really where... There's many more questions I want to talk to you about your career development, I guess, but I do see where you're coming from, and it is... I find it scary to see how people will watch a 30-minute YouTube video and then think that they're an expert on the subject. And that's truly right. Not the case. And that is scary. I think that is a scary thing that's happening in society today. But I guess it's not where I was coming from when I was saying that I don't believe in higher education the same way that you're saying it, right? It's that we see this as a limitation. I'm seeing it as... some people hold it as a limitation to not being able to do certain things when the information is there. They need to do the same amount of work that you would have done if you would have went to higher education. So it's not about watching a 30-minute YouTube video. It's about consuming dozens of books in this specific industry in a specific niche where you want to become an expert in, right?
Yeah. And I would add, and this need not be a PhD wielding professor, but I would add also trading and refining and sharpening ideas with somebody who's your senior.
Yeah.
To bring us back on trails, on path, this does connect to the question you actually asked me. So here's the world as I see it and as I experienced it. Many of the mechanisms in today's world, as far as I can tell, are designed to make us feel insecure or are designed to make us feel a little bit depressed. You know, we look at compelling marketing, and I'm super affected by marketing. It will lead us to believe, perhaps consciously, perhaps unconsciously, I won't actually be happy, or I won't actually be worthy, or I won't actually be, you know, meaningful unless I get this widget. And then, of course, we've all had the experience of getting a new MacBook or a new car, or just eating a cupcake and then realizing, shit, that did not suddenly make me think that I'm worth something. I don't love myself any more than I did before. In fact, I might hate myself a little bit more. And then likewise, we watch the news, and I don't think many people understand consciously what's going on when they watch the news. Now, many of us know that the news is trading in our attention for dollars and cents. This is common knowledge now. But the way that they work this is basically by inspiring a sense of anxiety within us. And the anxiety, if it could speak, basically says, gosh, if I don't keep watching this thing through the commercial break or through the ad or whatever, I might be unaware of information that I really need to have in order to make myself feel stable and secure in this world. So we're surrounded by news. We're surrounded by advertisements, all telling us that we are less than, that we're broken. And I certainly have felt this way a million times in my life. And then suddenly this industry crops up of life coaching and personal development and magical oils and all this other stuff that plays on this and says, look, you don't have the success that you want. You don't have the happiness that you want. You don't have the sex that you want. You don't have the money that you want, whatever it is. Look, this coach can help you get it. And I think the truth of this is messy, right? There are coaches out there that are better than the average therapist. And there are therapists out there that are way worse than the average coach. However, and this is why I turned my back on this industry. I briefly worked as a fairly in demand and successful executive coach. There's no regulation in coaching, and much of what we know, if somebody has an intrinsic sense of unworthiness, which again, I would argue society drills into us, and not to mention traumas that might've happened in our lives. Some of the stuff that is intuitive about building that sense of worthiness just doesn't work. And it often causes more harm. It's not that it's neutral. It actually makes things worse. And there's nothing in coaching to protect from that. Therapists both have education and supervision that protects the consumer a little bit more and is a little bit more honest. So it's messy, but that's why I wound up writing articles and about, hey, I think this is bad. I think we're making mistakes when we turn to life coaches. And I think I made a mistake in working as a coach for a while. And I'm going to close down a successful business to go back to school and pull myself into integrity.
So let's say we rewind in your career progression a bit, and you're starting to want to work as a speaker. You went from doing this volunteer work, this semi-volunteer work, traveling through sponsorships to help poorer countries, let's say, is where you did. What motivated you to start traveling and doing volunteer work out in these poorer countries?
Well, I think there were two things. One, like just a raw desire to see the world, and how lucky was I to be able to take on that desire. You know, I read about the world, and I grew up in a small town. My first school in Florida was in a small town. I just wanted to see it. So part of it was this just like unbridled, gosh, I'd love to see that. And I didn't grow up super rich by any means, nor am I super rich right now. But also I didn't grow up needing to worry about food or anything like that, or shelter. On the arc of the world, you know, I was very, very, very privileged. And I somehow, probably to my parents' credit, became aware of that. And it just seemed like a nice fit of, gosh, there's people out there who are less fortunate than I am. I would love to see if I can help them. I think that might be meaningful to me, and hopefully it's meaningful to them. And I'd love to see the world. So it was, for me, it felt like a very clear combination of desires that I'd have for a while.
Okay. Did you ever fear that you were not progressing towards a career? So I guess that's what my own fears when I was younger was that I needed to establish a career because that's what it seems that society wanted of me. So as you're traveling, do you have an idea of what kind of career that you want to have, or you're saying this is fun for the moment and I'm going to do this?
It was much more, this is fun for the moment and I'm going to do this. I think a positive thing that came from being a child entertainer was an understanding of business mechanics, as well as a sense of like, gosh, you know, if push comes to shove, I can do magic tricks and make enough money to pay rent and buy food.
Okay. So what made you say, all right, this is enough. I need to come into the speaking field. What made you want to start being a speaker from this experience?
So there's a surface level answer, and then I want to give you what is probably a more true answer. The surface level answer is I was called towards speaking. And this is a mistake that a lot of speakers make. A lot of people decide, you know, I have something to say. People, I bet, want to hear it. I wasn't quite in that situation. I was in a situation where after I got back from traveling, universities were saying to me, hey, Jason, we want you to speak to our students. So I was pulled into that industry. And then because of my background in entertainment, I could do it fairly okay. That's the surface level reason. It was still a lot of work to build that business, but it was a business that the world was asking me to build. I think in hindsight, though, at the deeper level, and this is why I mentioned the complexity of being a child entertainer. You know, when a speech goes well, it looks sort of like this. You wake up in your hometown. A car picks you up and takes you to the airport. you wait in the airport in the first class lounge, you check into your flight, you fly first class, a car picks you up, you drop your bags in a nice hotel, often a very big room, you step on stage in front of hundreds, and eventually, if you get good, thousands of people, you give a very tight talk for 60 minutes or 75 minutes, they stand up and clap for you, and then you reverse the entire procedure, and you make a load of money along the way. And I think unconsciously, in fact, I know unconsciously, that I thought if I could achieve some level of success as a speaker and get all that external validation, that finally that hole in me that thought I was unworthy would close up and I would heal. And the truth of the matter is that success, as far as I can tell, both personally and clinically, exacerbates how you already feel about yourself. So I had eventually found myself in this situation of being able to sell out world tours in 2 weeks or less, making more money in an evening that some of my friends made in a month or a quarter, yeah, and being even more miserable than I was. Okay. So that's why I turned towards speaking, and that's why I turned away from it.
So I read your article about why you decided to leave speaking, but a lot of it seemed to be that the disconnect of having to do this day in and day out and the traveling and all that. And I understand that I traveled for 3 years repairing instruments in hospitals. And that's one of the big reasons I wanted to leave that is that I was basically living for the weekends because I was in hotels at night and during the week. I could never plan out saying, oh, Wednesdays, I'm going to go play badminton because it's badminton day, because I never know where I'm going to be on Wednesday. So This lack of a regular life makes it very hard. And I'm sure that's the speaker lifestyle as well. And what I am interested in speaking, but I am afraid of that. I know that I don't like the lifestyle. So that makes me think that, well, if you're making as much as your friends are making in a month and a night, then can you not do this 12 times a year and then spend the rest of your time enjoying your life and doing things that you're passionate about that you can do without having to find a monetary a reward for it, because you don't need it. You have this speaking engagement you're doing once a month to keep you going. And I'm kind of curious on, you were at a position where you could have probably done that, but chose to close it off completely. And I'm curious on why and what was your reasoning behind that?
Yeah, great, really great question. I think there are many people in this world who could give 4 or 10 speeches a year. It would supplement their income, they'd be very, very happy. You know, that would be their entire years of work, or it would be, you know, adjunct to something else they do. I think for myself, I had just needed really clean lines because I had been from 6 to 18, I was a child entertainer. And then I had a couple of years off in university, but then at 22 to 30, I was as a speaker, another form of entertainer. And I think for me to really, this language sounds a little saccharine, but to find myself or to find my truth, I needed to shut it all down and get rid of all the things that weren't fully in integrity and really turn the volume on my life down. So the path that you laid out, hey, couldn't you just give 4 speeches a year? I think a lot of people could. I think it's a nice life, nice business. Yeah. But it wouldn't have worked for me. I needed to bring the volume way down and listen to myself.
Okay. Which is interesting. And that's, I'm projecting my own thoughts into what I... Because what I want is to be able to work. I'm not saying I want to work a 4-hour work week, but I'm looking more towards living a cheap life and being able to have control of my time. So that's why I see something like this as a really great kind of way to doing things, especially since I do enjoy speaking. It's something I can't say I've always enjoyed, but I've discovered that I do enjoy doing, right? So, and even this podcast, if I could do this podcast just for fun without ever having to think that, well, if I want to do this for a living, I need to find a way to monetize it. It sucks the fun out of it, right? Doesn't it? When you know that if you want to keep doing this or knowing in the back of your mind that you have to do something to make money, to me, saps the fun out of anything. And being able to have something where you can do that you don't mind doing and generates income, to me is fun. But I see that people have different priorities, right? So if it's always been, growing up, you had all this money that you eventually gave away. And then you had this business that did super well that you probably banked a bit on. And so money has never been an issue, I imagine, in your life. So it's never something that you had to weirdly worry about, because when you did, you had maybe the work ethic that you needed to make something great and not have to worry about money. So I guess I'm kind of curious on what your relationship to money has been. and what is it now? And how? Go ahead.
Hearing you parrot my story back to me, I mean, your interpretation seems perfectly valid that I like have a easy relationship to money. You did a very good job tracking everything I said. And that impression, this is my fault, not yours, is exactly wrong. I, for many years of my life, had a very complicated relationship to money. On one hand, you know, entertainers and speakers make a lot of money. So I had access to enough, more than enough. But on the other hand, spending that money really stressed me out because, and also I mostly thought about money from a perspective of scarcity. And again, like if I were to unravel this, I think it was a matter of self-worth. Like as an entertainer, as a speaker, in the arc of my life, as I experienced it, speaking was a natural outgrowth of entertainment, of being a magician. This was never in integrity. This was never something I chose to do for myself. It felt like, or I should say, I wasn't the one that toppled the first domino. Someone else did that in my life. So my sense of self was shot, and I knew I wasn't going to always be able to make it as a speaker and be in integrity. And I don't know that I felt like I was worth all the accolades that I was getting. So I actually had a pretty complicated relationship to money. Like there was enough of it, but it made me uncomfortable to spend, and it made me uncomfortable to have. And it's one of the main reasons that I started therapy as a client was this intellectual disconnect of, gosh, I shouldn't be insecure about money, and I am. So I turned up in my therapist's office and so began a new chapter.
Yeah. And something that I find interesting in one of your writings, I have it written as a note, but I don't remember where I took it from. But you said that you changed your business to work that supported your life and not vice versa. And I'm kind of curious on if you remember this and if you specifically kind of know what you did and how you felt when you did that decision to change your business so that work supported your life and not vice versa. Mm.
Yeah, I thank you for pulling that one out. That's one that still means a lot to me and still years later, I stand by. So it is not lost on me how lucky I've been and how privileged I've been, but there's many levels of wealth I never achieved, but most of the stuff that entrepreneurs want or entertainers want when they start working for themselves, freedom of time and abundance of money, a lot of status, I actually had that stuff. And I was still miserable. So this was sort of a logical thing for me. I realized, gosh, you know, I got the stuff that I thought would make me happy. And it didn't make me happy. I prioritized all these status symbols and all these external forms of validation and stability. I got to try something else. So I had shifted, you know, after years of my life working like a dog to let me figure out a couple things in life that make me happy. And if that means I make less money and it means I can't whatever, spontaneously hop on a jet to go to Costa Rica, so be it. Maybe this is a better path for me.
Sure. And I do see that. And so once you finished your speaking, you went into coaching. And so you probably had an idea that coaching is going to bring you more happiness than just traveling, doing some speeches. So what was your, I guess my question is, how did you think that that was going to be a better option? And why was that wrong?
Well, it was almost right, actually. I appreciate the question. So with speaking, it was easy to move to coaching. So I had, this again is a little bit rare and it would be hard for someone in my position to do now. If you're a 22-year-old that nobody's ever heard of, it'd be hard to do now. But I was successful as a speaker and I had some fairly big clients, professional sports teams, Fortune 100 companies, et cetera. And an offshoot of that was just constant inquiries if I was open to coaching. And I was always saying no, because I was too busy. You know, I was on the road 150, 200 days a year touring. And I didn't want to spend more time doing this work. But when I quit touring, the inbound requests for coaching were still coming my way. So I said, yeah, sure, I'd love to, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I loved it. But I had gotten a couple things wrong with coaching too. What I loved about it was that I was having these real sort of like gritty relationships with people. And I was taking what I had learned in life, which probably isn't even all that much, but I've learned a little bit. And I was able to give it to other people and help them live their lives. But here are the two mistakes. And I eventually got it right. The first mistake was, I still had this like complicated relationship to money. So when I thought about that coaching business, I thought the first question I asked myself was, how can this business make enough money so I don't have to worry about money? A pretty normal question for an entrepreneur to ask him or herself.
For sure. I think it's an important question as well.
Yes and no. We might come back to that. I think now the first question I ask myself now as a therapist is much messier. The question is some version of, what can I do to help my clients heal and get the results from life that they want in a way that is responsible for them and responsible for me. So my focus as a coach by a couple of years ago was starting with finance. And I'm ashamed to admit that. It's embarrassing. I think it's bad for someone working in mental health. Now, my focus is this messiness of like, how can everyone get their goals in a way that like everybody is better off for it? So that was the first mistake that I made. And that one was a little obscure to me when I was working as a coach. But the mistake that became obvious to me is that even if they don't think they are, coaches are mental health professionals. So my clients were these people with true influence, but also like deep felt lived experiences of life. And they were talking to me about addiction and childhood abuse and infidelity and issues with trust and all this other stuff. And this is where I started to get a little bit luckier as far as the arc of my career goes. I realized, God, I want to work on these issues of abuse and addiction and the sort of puzzle of happiness and self-worth, but I'm in over my head. All I've known in life is entertainment, and I've read a couple of good books and I've got a few ideas. I don't really know how to help these people. So months after standing up the business, I closed it down.
Yeah. And I understand that. Do you feel that your schooling that you've done now has made you much better in being able to treat these situations?
Yeah. So I did a lot. Like I went back to grad school full time after leaving executive and life coaching. I became a consultant to speakers, and that business works. Like that business feels an integrity to me.
Well, yeah, exactly. So that kind of coaching could have been your bread and butter the whole time, right? Or do you find
yes.
that?
Yes. That business would have worked forever.
And did it like not
when I,
interest
when I closed
you,
that, or? I had offers to sell it.
Okay.
Well, so what happened, and like I've hinted at this a little bit, but to speak to it directly, at some point in my late 20s, early 30s, I went into therapy and it changed my life. It wasn't quick. You know, coaches promise these quick results. But what made a huge difference in my life was taking the time to really examine my past and feel feelings that I hadn't felt before and heal over some of the wounds and scars that were damaging my sense of self-worth and damaging my ability to be happy and flourish in this world. And concurrently, I was journaling and concurrently, I was meditating. So none of these things are fancy. There's no like sexy, like headline version of what I did. But eventually, I became happier and I became happier with less. And my relationships got better. And ironically, my consultancy for professional speakers started doing much, much better, moved from myself and an assistant to myself and 13 other people. And this business was humming and doing really well. And then as I emotionally and existentially got to a point where I was happy with life, I started reflecting on my career and realized, gosh, you know, this consultancy I could do forever. And I was at the gym, and one of the trainers of the gym was going back and getting his PhD in psychology. I was like, God, that's so cool. And he had been a professional athlete. And I had asked him, I was like, how did you know that you wanted to go back to school? He's in your 40s. And he's like, you know, it hit me. I realized that if I don't go back to school and become a psychologist, which is what I really want to do, that this is as good as my life is going to get. I'll be a former professional athlete and a trainer, and I want to do more. And that woke something up in me. I realized, gosh, my life's pretty good, but this is not my calling to consult with speakers. My calling, I think, is to help people heal and fall in love with themselves and their lives. So I feel like I'm becoming a parent of myself. I closed down a business again, went back to school, and to answer the question you asked, yeah, I did a couple things. I got advanced training in clinical social work, counseling basically, as well as advanced training that I'm still in teaching meditation, 2.5 year training. And this really helped me understand how people's hearts and minds are destroyed and how we can mend them too.
So do you find that, is it kind of funny looking back through your life of looking at your first major that you chose when you went to university in Florida and they say, I was right all along and I just took a weird kind of path to get back to the same spot? Or?
Yeah, that's not lost. That's not lost on me. I go through phases of reading these books about people who like, there's this book Replay by Ken Grimwood. And briefly, you learn this in the first couple pages of the book. The main character dies in his like late 30s or mid 40s or something. And then he wakes up again as an 18-year-old with all the knowledge that he had. And I find myself reading these books and getting lost in these like, hey man, you knew when you're 18, like how would your life be different if you just trusted yourself then? But yeah. You know, at the time I had a different path for me.
That's right. And it's only looking back that you can kind of see this, right? Because how you felt before you went back to study psychology and how you felt when you were studying psychology, you were a different person, right? You have had a boatload of human experiences that changed your perspective on things, right?
Yeah. And it's funny, when I was 18 and studying psychology, the reason that I told my parents and my friends for quitting that major was, God, you know, the other psychology students are so crazy. I don't want to deal with them. In hindsight, what I realize is I was so crazy. I was not yet ready to deal with my own psychology, and I was not yet ready to actually heal all the shit that had sort of, in its weird way, been serving me. And I can't tolerate this environment.
Okay. And you feel that you're on the right path now more than you felt than when you were starting to be successful as a speaker? Because I imagine that when you were starting to be successful as a speaker, you must have felt like, oh, this is finally what I wanted to do all my life, and I'm doing it right now.
No, I never felt that way. What I felt as a speaker was, if I hit this next milestone, then I'll be happy. And that's what I want to do. So my first speech, I had to pay my own way for 8 hours. I think it was like a $35 ticket on a Greyhound bus. And I told myself the story, you know, if somebody ever like just pays for my bus ticket, I'll be happy. And I told this myself the story, although I never went on a private jet, but at the end of my career, I was like, you know, maybe I'd like being a speaker if somebody paid for a private jet for me. That might be nice. Now I think, gosh, you know, I'd like to be a better therapist, a better meditation teacher than I am. And I'm pursuing trainings. But when I'm in session with a client or when I'm working on that business, I tend to think to myself, gosh, this is hard. I've got a lot to learn. And good Lord, do I love it. Good Lord, do I feel lucky to be doing this. And I don't think I ever honestly felt that way as a magician, speaker, coach, or consultant.
Did you foresee this as you were meditating on what you think your next step would be? Maybe meditating is the right, but contemplating your next step in life. Did you foresee that this was going to feel right?
No, I thought, I'm 34. I thought that by 34, I would be married and a multimillionaire, and I'm neither. So, you know, I make enough money and I have a girlfriend I feel very fortunate for. But at some point, this is maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had healed up a lot of my psychological wounds, and then was intentionally thinking about life strategy. And before I went to grad school, I had shadowed a bunch of different professions that I was interested in. I had done a lot of reflection. I had asked a bunch of my friends, what do you think I'd like to do and be good at? And by the time I had applied to grad school, I was pretty confident that this weird combination of therapy and meditation and business would be right for me. So to have, I'm just at the first stages of this out in the real world, but to have arrived there feeling like it's right is not surprising to me. But my eyes, I was pretty blind to that until 2 or 3 years ago.
And something that I find that in all of the conversations I had doing this podcast is many people stumbled upon to something where they can eventually say that they're really happy. Like you said, that what I love the most and my objective in life, I guess, is what you just mentioned of saying that you're doing this and you're loving it. And I've had some experiences of doing some of that, or I've had that at the start of something. My last job, the start of my job, I was like, I can't believe I'm getting paid so much money to be doing this right now. But eventually it grows old when things kind of get stale, when I stop learning, right? But at the same point, on an employer's point of view, that's when you start being valuable, right? Because you're not learning anymore. You're actually performing work at a higher level. But to me, I get bored, and that's when I feel like I need to change. And it's my continual journey of trying to find this kind of work or this this pursuit that I can do that's going to continually provide this satisfaction that I'm looking for. But it's been, and I'm starting to, at 37 now, I'm starting to realize that maybe my path is going to be this continually trying new things, because I do enjoy, new experiences and new endeavors. So, I guess I'm kind of curious on maybe more of the specifics of how what you did to decide that this was what was going to be it for you. Or
great question. I actually, in a moment, have a question for you. So I could be prescriptive and I could say, you know, I did these 8 steps and this resulted in me figuring out what I want to do, at least for now, but that would be a little disingenuous. It took me a while to realize this. In my instance, this might be true for you. I mean, you sound successful enough and ambitious enough and skilled enough. Maybe it's not true for you. I don't know. In my instance, I had a lot of psychological and spiritual wounds that prevented me from stepping onto my path and that prevented me from from being, for lack of a better phrasing, myself.
Were you aware of
it? No. Okay. Not really. Like,
I didn't want to interrupt.
They were mostly, no, you're fine. They were mostly in my blind spot.
Okay.
And it was work. It was 3 years of work to heal them over. And there was a lot of luck and a lot of serendipity in being able to do that. But once they were healed over, then all the stuff, many of the things I struggled with in life either went away or the volume turned from 11 down to like 3 or 4 and they felt manageable. And finding my path for me was a side effect of healing over those wounds.
Okay. Because that's what I'm curious about is the, I guess I'm wondering, I've tried therapy before with never any kind of success, but nothing very long. It's always been kind of just a weird experience, to be honest. But I'm curious if, is it something that I'm not aware of? Because that's always kind of the curious part of things, right? Is it, do I have some stuff that I need to deal with that I'm unaware of that's making me continually job hop from one thing to the next? And my career has been very varied in different kind of fields. And it's kind of weird how, you know, I'm an engineer wanting to be an entertainer is kind of where I'm sitting at right now. But concretely, I'm kind of still trying to figure it out, right? And I've done a lot of exercises to figure it out without having really found anything concrete. But I do enjoy talking to people. I do enjoy having a conversation. Getting to meet someone is something that I really enjoy. And having a podcast is an excuse to have a conversation with Jason Connell that I would have never had before. Right? It's a way that, and I find it awesome to get your point of view because you've lived things that through your writing, I felt like I was able to live vicariously through your experiences and try to apply some of these learnings to my own life, right? It's still, I'm kind of still curious on how to get to that step, right? And I think this is where this podcast is going to lead on is my own journey in trying to find that. Because I think a lot of people are a bit lost in this situation where if you're educated, it kind of opens up a lot of maybe a lot of opportunities. And as much as I don't believe in higher education, it did open up a ton of opportunities for me, especially in engineering. So I see all these opportunities and I don't really know what I want to do. So The Paradox of Choice, it's a book I read saying how we get paralyzed with the amount of choices that we have today. And I feel that I'm suffering from that in the sense that I have a lot of options that I know I could do, but I don't know exactly what I want to do. So where I don't know how to navigate myself through that. And that's why I'm having conversations with people and seeing how they navigated through that and how they made it. So that's kind of why I'm curious about maybe the steps that you took to get to that. And I kind of interrupted your train of thought a while ago. So I'm wondering if...
No, that's fine. You can edit this out if you want, but I have questions for you. I mean,
yeah.
At this point, what you just said to me is much more interesting than anything I might say to you or a listener.
Sure.
I'll explain to you the situation it seems like you're in. It seems to me like you're a very smart, very talented guy. Like a million different paths are open to you and you're searching externally for some light down the path. Now, I am a big fan of external guides in the form of friends, significant others, therapists, meditation teachers, etc.
Yeah.
But I wonder if your wisest self, I mean, if the 70-year-old version of you were to just like appear in front of you and give you guidance for this point in your life, what do you think he'd say to you?
I don't know. That's the questions. I'm very introspective and it's something that I think about a lot is where would I think I would want to be? And for the longest time, if you could give me the perfect kind of job, what if, you know, the question of if you know, you would not fail, what would you do? And my answer would have been talk show host for the longest time. But then I'm thinking like, you know what? I'd like to sing in front of a crowd. And I don't sing at all. I play a bit of guitar and I tried to play piano and that kind of failed. But it's, you know, but being in front of a crowd, being able to kind of rile up a crowd would be something that's very interesting to me. But then it makes me wonder why. Why do I want to rile up a crowd? What do I find interesting about doing this? And I wonder, is it for validation? Maybe. And that's, I sent you an email several months back, I guess, and you responded to, but about how I was questioning myself about that as well, right? Am I just looking for validation, trying to fix some kind of black sheep feeling that I had in school of being a bit of an outcast, right? It's something that I wonder if, could this be a blind spot where you said that you went to, you had these blind spots where you had to work on before things opened up for you. But at the same point, I feel like I'm doing well, but at the same time, I do feel this constant pressure of having to find the path because I'm 37, not knowing what I want to do with my life, right?
I don't have answers for you, but two things do come to mind for me. One, and I think the Buddhists really get this right, though I myself am not a Buddhist. They start with the assumption in life that life is intrinsically unsatisfactory. The word in Pali is dukkha, which often gets translated as suffering. To be alive is to suffer. But I think a better translation is unsatisfactory or unsatisfactoriness. It's often compared to a squeaky wheel on a cart. Cart can still move, but it's a bitch.
Yeah.
So the Buddhists start, look, life is going to be unsatisfactory no matter what. What do we do about it? And I notice in the West that we seem to think that we are failing at life unless everything in our life is satisfactory. And I think that's a flawed perspective. So that's one thing to add to the tension, because in part, what I'm saying to you is, hey, Marcel, maybe you don't need a perfect job. And I just stand by that. I like what I do. But I think to have our primary worth come from our work is a mistake. And here's where the tension comes in. Man, 3 or 4 times on this interview, I have heard you say, gosh, you know, maybe I'm craving the validation. And you locked in on a level, I think, of relating to when I was talking about my blind spots. And candidly, you know, I'm pretty responsive to emails and I am available as a clinician. I am available as a consultant. You didn't need to have this conversation with me on a podcast. But I'm glad that we did. I mean, it's an honor. I hope this conversation helps other people. Yeah. But what I'm tuning into is this shared still point between the two of us. For many, many, many years in my life, I unconsciously and sometimes consciously thought the validation would do something for me, and it did not. And I would posit to you that it will not, and to anyone that's a false god. This is a long conversation I used to have with my speakers. So I don't know.
Yeah,
and that's what stood out to me as I listened to you.
For sure. But I guess it's a question, and I'm wondering if it's a question that I started thinking about more after I read that article and after we had that exchange, because you specifically said in your article that if you're looking for validation and whatnot, it's probably the wrong reasons. And I do think that there's a lot of truth to that. I wonder, is that really what I'm looking for? Is that just an option? Because I usually think about all of the options when I think a lot about everything a bit too much, making me paralyzing me, right? If you think about all the options, then it's hard to make a choice because you've seen all the opportunity costs of taking one action versus another, right? So it makes it hard to have a solid choice in the end. But
totally. Just to respond to that briefly, like for you, for my own reinforcement of my own life, and for anyone that has bothered to listen this deep into the podcast, you're doing something that is very familiar to me, and it's very familiar to a lot of people that I've worked with. You're thinking this through. In the West, we are a very, very, very rational, thought-centric culture. And this has done incredible things. We built rockets. It's incredible. And I remember when I was 23, a girlfriend had gone to yoga class and she came back from yoga and said, you know, the yoga teacher told us that our sort of below our stomach, between our crotch and our belly button is where creativity is held. And I just remember telling my girlfriend, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. This idea that feelings are held in our body. Now, a decade later, and with much better training, much more experience in life, one of the things that I am most convinced of is that there's a lot of wisdom and there's a lot of history held in our body. So if mentally, when I hear someone and when I notice myself mentally running in circles, I think it's really nice to shift out of our head and into our body. It's not exactly like your body is going to say, ah, Marcel, your exact calling in life is to whatever, be a novelist in the vein of Haruki Murakami. But what your body might say, you might imagine a situation where your podcast is as successful as, you know, Tim Ferriss's podcast or something like that. And where you're doing that life that you envision, you know, I'll do 10 speeches a year, I'll make $100,000 and that'll be it. And then seeing how your body reacts to that, if there's a sense of expansion or contraction. And it might just be a trickle where we're very disembodied in this culture. And it's why I looked at my girlfriend. I was like, this is the stupidest thing that you just told me about creativity of the stomach. But the more embodied we become, I think the more clear we get. And our minds will always run crazy thinking things through. But our onus is just not to believe all of our thoughts.
For sure. And yeah, definitely. But and man, there's so many things I'd like to talk about, but I know you have a hard stop, so we're gonna end it here. And I just like to thank you sincerely for this conversation. I'm as impressed in your conversation skills as I am in your writing skills. I'd like to just push it out to you. So, what do you want people to know that you're doing right now? Like, where? How would you like to influence or connect with people listening, other than in your obvious writing on your website?
If anyone masochistic enough to still be interested in my thoughts and my work, jasonconnell.co is the place to go. I jump on my mailing list, which is easily visible on the main page and elsewhere. And that's the clearinghouse for anything else that I might be doing. When I teach meditation classes for now online for free, when those are available, it comes out to my mailing list first. When I have openings in my clinical practice, that comes out to my mailing list first. That's by far the best place. I actually don't do much with social media. It makes me crazy, mostly.
Well, I really appreciate it. And I am on your mailing list. It's one of two. I'm subscribed to two mailing lists. And I'm always excited when I see an email from you. And I'm always I always enjoy reading your articles. So thanks a lot, Jason. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, and I'm looking forward to seeing more content that you create.
Oh my gosh, my honor, Marcel. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the whole episode of the Hired by Passion podcast with my guest, Jason Connell. This podcast was really important for me personally, I guess, because it made me dig down deeper inside myself and to try to think about why I wanted the things I wanted and what motivated me for this. And it really inspired me, and it was the conversation I needed to finally take the first steps to get some mental health. It's kind of weird to say mental health help. Yeah, there we go. Anyways, it's something we don't talk about too much, and I think we do need to talk about it a lot. And it's funny because the more I've been opening up to different people, more people have opened up to me and tell me how seeing a psychologist or whatever, or a coach, help them through their own issues. And it really inspired me to say, why not give it a try? And so I'm doing that right now. It's a bit of a slow process. I'm going through the public system. It's slow, but hopefully, you know, it's going to work out. Plus, I've been doing a lot of searching on my own, finding out different things, and probably some stuff I'll be talking to you guys about later on. But just to say that it's take care of yourself, right? And try to figure out what is motivating you, and try to see if it's really something that you think that you'll find at the end of the rainbow. Because I'm changing a lot of my perspective on a lot of things the more I've been digging deep thinking about this. So I invite you to do the same, and hopefully that maybe this conversation that I had can inspire you to finally take the steps that you need to take care of yourself. So if you have any questions, always feel free to contact me. You can find me on the Hired by Passion Facebook page. Just search for Hired by Passion on Facebook, or if you search for Hired by Passion on Google, there should be a way to, you'll be able to find yourself to the Hired by Passion Facebook group. And that's where you can, or Facebook page. And that's where you can contact me. So feel free to send me a message, and I'll be glad to talk to you guys. So thanks a lot for sticking around till the end of the episode, and hopefully I'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening to the Hired by Passion podcast. If you enjoyed the show, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating and review on iTunes.